Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Hello, good morning. Good morning from London. It's April 22nd, 2007, 0534 hours Greenwich Mean Time. And this is Solder Smoke 55, the Solar Minimum Edition. I want to open this morning with an interesting report that came across the QRPL net from our friend Paul and A5N out at the Very Large Array, the VLA Observatories. Paul's been very good over the years about sharing with homebrewers and QRPers his expertise and knowledge of solar conditions, and a report came through on the 18th of April that I found very interesting, entitled Solar Minimum Here? ? And it says that it appears that we are at or nearly at the solar minimum. It provides some flux charts, describes what's going on, and then gets to the bottom line. It says, for the good old days, with 28 days solar flux varying between 100 and 150, and with solar activity shooting at above 200, those are still a few years away. More specific to ham radio, the solar minimum represents the minimal amount of ionizing radiation that the sun delivers to the Earth. As a result, our ENF layers are not being well ionized right now, and thus not very reflective. Once the sun goes away at local sundown, recombination of the free electrons is very swift. This is why 20 meters shuts down pretty much right at dusk, compared to staying open into the wee hours of the night when solar flux is above 100, or around the clock at the solar maximum. When the ionizing radiation from the sun stops at sundown, the maximum usable frequency drops to around 10 to 12 megahertz right now, shutting down 20 meters. And many of us can can attest to that. During the more active sun, the MUF seldom drops below 18 megahertz, allowing 20 meters to be open 24 hours a day. Paul's message has a lot of interesting information in there. He goes on to talk about the solar wind and what's happening with the solar wind. Solar wind buffeting the Earth is what causes noise on the lower bands. Sure, these bands are noisy. They're always noisy. But not all of that noise is due to the sun. Right now, those low sodium vapor lights at your nearby Walmart parking lot are contributing more noise than the sun. Paul goes on, at my QTH near Socorro, New Mexico, the largest source of 40-meter noise is the Burger King sign. In other words, what you are hearing on 80 40 meters right now is about as good as it gets. When the sun wakes up, it will only get worse. Paul points out here, right now, 20 meters is the daytime band and 40 meters is the nighttime band. Very interesting. Thanks very much for that, Paul. And that kind of puts the big picture in clearer view there. I guess we have kind of an astronomical or outer space theme here this week. Just seemed to work out that way. Another piece of news that came across the workbench here was about the meteor shower. The Leirid's meteor shower peaking, I think, tonight. So you guys might want to, those of you who are listening on the appropriate day, might want to take a look out the window. Those of you who are listening in May or June, disregard. But there's a report out, a report here saying that the Leyritz meteor shower is supposed to peak tonight. Some interesting information about this. It says here, this meteor shower has been observed for more than 2,000 years. Chinese records say stars fell like rain during the shower of 687 BC. But in recent times, the Leyrids have generally been weak. They have a brief maximum lasts for less than a day, and even then, only 10 to 12 Leyrid meteors per hour may appear. It says here there have been some remarkable exceptions. In 1982, the rate unexpectedly reached 90 for a single hour, and 180 to 300 for a few minutes. A brief outburst of 100 per hour was also seen in 1922. And on April 20, 1803, residents of Richmond, Virginia, upon being rousted out of bed by a fire bell, were startled to see great numbers of meteors in all parts of the sky. This unpredictability always makes Leyrid's shower to watch, since we cannot say when the next unusual return may occur, notes Alistair McBeath in Rainier Art of the International Meteor Organization. So keep an eye open there, guys, for the meteor shower. And I think I've mentioned this. I've always wanted to get into meteor scatter communication. I made one very feeble attempt at it while out in the Azores. There was a guy a couple islands over that was into VHF, UHF, and I kind of left my 2-meter packet system on and aimed at him to see if he might be able to pick up some of my packets, but it didn't work out. I think a combination of QRP output and a very undirectional antenna with very little gain made that kind of a physical impossibility, but one of these days, meteor scatter will be added to the lists of crazy activities here in my shack. All right, continuing in outer space, another thing. I don't know, I wasn't really a Trekkie when I was a kid. I mean, I watched the show, but I'm not going to admit to being a real Star Trek fan. I think it's bad enough to have the social stigma of being a ham radio enthusiast. If I was to admit to being a Star Trek fan, I think that would really be a bit too much. You guys know what I'm talking about. But an article did catch my attention here. I came across BBC News. It's entitled "Space Shield to Block Radiation." This deals with the problem that space travelers have and will have, and will have more of in the future as we go further out on longer missions, and this is the need for shielding from particles zipping through space, both from the sun and from further out. And it describes efforts to create a shield, a Star Trek like shield. They have a picture here showing the Starship Enterprise being shielded, but scientists hope to mimic the magnetic field which protects the Earth. Goes on to describe what they're working on. And it notes that right now, crew members on the International Space Station can retreat to a thick-walled room in times of increased solar radiation. But when they're way out there, it's going to be more difficult to do that. And there's going to be more particles kind of randomly zipping through. And without the protection of the Earth's magnetosphere, it's bad news for a number of reasons. So what they're talking about doing now is using magnetic technology to create, in essence, an artificial magnetosphere around the spaceship as it goes out there. And interesting, very interesting developments there. Let's see here. It says here the team from the Rutherford Appleton plans to build an artificial magnetosphere in the laboratory. They would eventually like to fly a test satellite, which would test the technology in space. So, wow, very interesting. For those of us who play with magnets and magnetic fields and electromagnets and all those things we played with as kids, this is very interesting. They're combining it with plasma technology, putting plasma out in the out in the magnetic field. Not quite exactly sure how the plasma fits in, but very interesting stuff, and good luck with that. Let's see. Oh, speaking of magnetic fields, I think I might have mentioned on an earlier show the trivial electric motor that my son Billy and I built a while back. I came across this week plans for an almost, it's hard to imagine this, but an even cooler trivial electric motor called a homopolar electric motor. And it uses a little AA battery and one of these little circular high-power batteries that are floating around quite a bit now. And the YouTube video describes how to build it, and it is really neat. I have a prototype sort of working here. My problem is that I don't have the needed circular magnet. Mine is a little rectangular thing, so it kind of doesn't work as smoothly as it would with a cylindrical magnet. But check this out. I put a link to it on the Solder Smoke Gadgeteer video page. And hey, Billy just walked in.
There we go.
So now we're joined by the guy I was just talking about, my partner in magnet projects. And he just walked in, still kind of sleepy here, but glad to have you with us here, Bill. Anyway, check out the YouTube page that I mentioned for a discussion of the homopolar electric motors. Really pretty cool stuff, and I hope to get mine going here pretty soon. Let's see. What's next to mention? QST. There are a couple of things in the May QST that I thought were kind of fun and noteworthy here. The let me reach over and grab my edition. Very, very nice article by the guy who brought us Echolink K1RFD on sound cards, a review of sound cards, and a nice article there by Craig Johnson, Alpha Alpha Zero Zulu Zulu, on learning to pick with the Pick L Part 1. Our friend Mike would have really liked that. He was into pick chips and all that. But one of the articles that caught my attention this week was the hands-on radio series by H. Ward Silver, N0AX. Really a great series that that Ward has been running there in QST, and I've learned a lot from it. And this week, he discusses a simple circuit that I have always kind of scratched my head about. It's one of these things where I never really quite understood how it works. It's the simple SWR meter, the monomatch, and all that. And he gives a really good description of how this very simple circuit is able to separate energy going forward towards the antenna and energy bouncing back down the transmission line. I've got to spend some more time with it, because this is the kind of thing, like I said, it's sometimes you get a very simple circuit and you think, oh, well, there's nothing much to that. And then when you look at it, you realize there's some pretty interesting and complicated physics going on inside that small collection of parts. And I think the that SWR meter, you know, this is the kind of thing that all of us have, probably have three or four of them sitting around the shack. You open it up and there's a couple of diodes, a couple of capacitors, and some pickup wires there. You think, well, there's not much to it, but well, there is when you think about it. It does some pretty neat things for us. And Ward's article, I think, makes a big contribution, at least for me, to my understanding of how this thing works. The other article that I caught there that I really liked was the old radio column. And let's see, page 86. Let me flip to that. Yeah. John Dilks, K2TQN, in his old radio column. This is one of my another one of my favorite parts of QST. I met John a few years back at one of the Washington, D.C. area hamfests. He came by with his really amazing van with all the old radios in there. This week, this month, he has an article called The Club Saver Revisited. And this is a story about a homebrew rig that the WCRA Radio Club developed in 1957. It was a simple 2-meter AM transceiver. Apparently the club activity was in decline, and they were looking for something to get people interested in ham radio and pull everybody together. So they designed a simple 2-meter AM transceiver. It looks very much like a Heathkit Benton Harbor lunchbox rig. And there's a great picture there with the club members sitting there with, it looks like, must be 25 of these things that they built, all pretty much identical. And they had great fun building them, and then they used them to, I think, keep people together and create a club net. And, man, it just sounds like a great project. So take a look at that. That's a real good article in this month's QST. Okay, what's on the list? Oh, not much workbench activity to report this week. Had some other projects going on. But, you know, a lot of guys will say that they don't have a whole lot of time for ham radio and home brewing, and I'm sure almost all of us are in that situation. But every once in a while, you get to do something that just takes a few minutes that's somehow very satisfying. And I had one of those kind of homebrew adventures, well, not really adventure, but homebrew activities this week. I mentioned last week that at the Kempton Park radio rally, I picked up some air variable capacitors. And I, just while I was sitting here one morning this week before work, I decided, let me measure the values of these things, see what I have here. So I pulled out my beloved, almost all digital electronics LC meter that my wife got for me a while back, and just put the test leads across these air variables and was able to measure and get out the marker and mark on the back what the values of these things are. And very satisfying. It makes them a whole lot more useful. I don't have to reach into the parts box and then wonder what they are. I eyeballed them pretty good. I thought that they had been like 300 picofarads, but it turns out that they were dual 500 picofarad air variables with nice ball bearing joints there. Keep them going. And I have another one here, a really ugly looking one, but with a really good value from 13 to 94 picofarads. So that thing will eventually find its way into a into a VFO or VXO of some sort here in a future project. The other technical activity is not really related to ham radio, but I guess it is, that Billy and I are involved in, is we're building a trap. That's right, guys. We're going to get into trapping. Trapping something right here in the wilds of central London. one of our favorite books is The Amateur Scientist by C.L. Strong. I think Mike and I were talking about this a while back, but a great book. And I got it as a kid. I think my mom got it for me as a birthday present one year, and it left a deep impression. It had some really great projects in there. I mean, atom smashing for amateurs, and how to build a cloud chamber, and some really, really hazardous amateur rocketry projects. And one of the things that caught my attention as a kid was this great little trap that you could make out of a coffee can, a mouse trap, and some wire mesh. The idea is to use the mouse trap as the mechanism to shut the door behind the wild beast that goes into the coffee can. And we built one in the Azores a while back and used it to capture what became known as John the Lizard. And so that was a great success. We kept John until his little aquarium house got so stinky that nobody could stand him anymore, at which point he had conveniently escaped and went back to the wilds of São Miguel Island. But anyway, that's the one of the homebrew projects that we have going this week, Billy and I. We went down to the local hardware store and picked up the mouse and rat traps and the wire mesh. We hope to get this thing together this week, and well, we'll report back on what we catch. I think we'll have to see what's running around out there at night. We'll check it out. Another parts story here I wanted to share with you, and Billy reminded me of this one. I had completely forgotten about it, but where is it? I have it here somewhere. It's on the bench somewhere. But I work in a section of London called Mayfair. And Mayfair is pretty famous. It's very central in central London. It's what would be referred to here as quite posh. It's the home of a lot of high value, high dollar financial firms and financial activities. And I have always thought of it as an area completely devoid of any connection with amateur radio or almost all forms of electronics, other than perhaps the computers that connect the traders and the brokers to the financial markets. So you can imagine my surprise last week when I walked out of work. I was walking down the street in Mayfair and then looked down on the ground, and what did I see at my feet as I waited for the light to change? A 10-ohm resistor, new, sitting there completely on its own out there in the street, on the sidewalk actually, in the heart of Mayfair, central London, England, UK. And what was that resistor doing there? Who had a resistor there? I mean, I briefly thought that it might have fallen out of my pocket on a previous day, but no, it's not kind of the kind I'm using. It's kind of a different make, and the markings on it a little bit different. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that I found it there, and so this is an indication that there is hope. There may be electronic activity in Mayfair. So I just thought I'd mention that. I don't know why, but one other technical project I wanted to mention, and maybe I can get some guidance on this from Solder Smoke listeners, especially the UK listeners. At the Kempton Park rally I mentioned last week, Tony Fishpool, G4WIF, gave me a copy of his excellent book, Simple Test Equipment for the QRP-er. You can find copies of that on Tony's website. There's the resistor. I found it. There it is, Bill. Look. All right. In the book, Tony mentions the something that I hadn't really given enough attention to, and that is the great benefit of using a current limited power supply. Of course, this allows you to prevent the smoke from escaping from transistors when you're testing them and putting them through all sorts of hazardous voltage and current conditions. I've been kind of stupidly using just regular old, not current limited power supplies, and of course this causes great volumes of current to flow through briefly flow through these resistors before the smoke is released and my fingers are burned, and well, you know how it gets. It's pretty ugly. But anyway, Tony's book mentioned the benefits of current limited supplies and made me realize that 6 months earlier at the previous Kempton Park rally, I had purchased a really neat looking power supply that has current limiting features, and I had never really used the thing. It's been kind of gathering dust underneath the workbench. But Tony's book made me realize that this is something I should press into service. So I pulled it out, and everything on it seems to be working okay, but the current limiting feature doesn't seem to be doing what it's supposed to do. I tested it by watching the output voltage and then putting resistors across the terminals, and it seems like the current limiting is kicking in at far lower current levels than indicated by the front panel controls. There's a little variable pot with a front panel control that lets you set the limiting current, for example, and I could set it at 300 mils, but then I'll put a resistor on it that'll draw only about 20 or 50 mils, and the thing will shut down And it's not supposed to, of course, not supposed to shut down in that case until you get up to 300 mils. But I'm thinking that maybe one of the regulator chips, or regulator transistors rather, might have gone bad. That might have been why it made its way to the Hamfest. I don't know. But anyway, there's a picture of this particular power supply on the Gadgeteer News website. Just go to www.gadgeteer.us, go to the Gadgeteer News page, and then scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see a picture of this thing. It's got a red and kind of an unusual red and blue box. If any of you guys could take a look at it, especially the UK hams, and see if you recognize it, know anything about it, that'd be great. The it looks like the regulator devices, they're mounted on the top of it to give them some cooling, but they're marked as follows: AD1496743, or it might be AD149G7423. There's two of them. They look like two transistors up there, and they're obviously used for the regulator. So if anybody knows anything about these devices or this this power supply, well, you might be able to make a contribution to an effort to prevent my transistors from burning up and my fingers from burning with them. All right. That kind of gets us through most of the news, but now it's time for a band sweep segment. And this band sweep segment is very consistent with our outer space theme for this week's show. This segment of band sweep was given to us very kindly by a long-term listener out there, Mike, WA6ARA. And, I really needed this because I didn't have time to record one yesterday. So I was sitting here this morning thinking, how am I gonna do this? And, lo and behold, there on the, in the email box was this very nice, email from Mike. He sends me, three files with three clips of contacts made through amateur radio satellites. I chose the VO52 bird for a couple of reasons. One, the QSOs that Mike recorded there were really interesting. They were in CW, and I know many of you guys are CW fans. You'll be able to hear the Doppler shift as the satellite approaches. You'll hear what'll sound to many of you like a badly drifting VFO. It's not drifting. What's happening is as the satellite approaches from low on the horizon, it's coming at the ground station quite quickly. And just like the whistle on a freight train changes pitch as it approaches, the tone of the CW changes pitch as it approaches. You'll notice that in the middle of the QSO, the speed of the Doppler shift seems to drop off a bit as the thing goes overhead, and then it seems to pick up again as the satellite moves away low towards the horizon. So I pick that. I like the CW, but I also like the fact that VO52, as the first letter indicates, is the Indian hamsat, and Solder Smoke has some important connections with India, and we have many listeners in India, and we're very involved in keeping an eye on the BidX20 project, of course, that has its roots in India. And India is, you know, it's such an important place for home brewing and QRP activity. We thought it appropriate to include some clips from the Indian hamsat VO52. I'll just read you a little bit about it. This is from the AMSAT page. It says, VUSAT Oscar 52, also known as VO52 HAMSAT, is a microsatellite for providing satellite-based amateur radio service to the national as well as the international community of amateur radio operators. Launched as an auxiliary payload on PSLV-6 by the Indian Space Research Organization, along with CARTOSAT-1, the 42.5 kilogram VO52 will meet the long-felt need of the amateur radio operators in the South Asian region who who possess the required equipment and operate in the VHF-UHF band for amateur satellites. One of the transponders on VL-52 was developed indigenously involving Indian hams with the expertise of ISRO and the experience of AMSAT India. VO-52 is India's contribution to the international community of amateur radio operators. This effort is meant to bring the Indian Space Research Organization's satellite services within the reach of the common man and popularize space technology among the masses. Well, fine business. That's really excellent. Like I said, a mass of about 42 kilograms. It's a small cube, 630 millimeters, basically in cuboid. It's in a near-circular polar low-Earth orbit. Its structure is aluminum honeycomb. Its power comes from body-mounted gallium arsenide solar panels with lithium-ion batteries. It's spin-stabilized. It's got UHF turnstile and VHF turnstile antennas. Its transponder has an uplink on 435 megahertz and a downlink on 145.9 megahertz. If anybody wants to listen to this, you can get the location from a number of different websites. The transmitter puts out 1 watt. So, guys, it qualifies as a QRP rig. Its modes of communication are CW and SSB. It sounds just like us. So, without further ado, I'll put on the clip that Mike sent us, and let you guys listen to a few minutes of the Indian Hamsat VO-52. Yeah. Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Mike, for sending us that. Listen, all this talk about India, there's something I just got to mention. It's not really completely related to ham radio, but I got to say this, and I'm going to ask for a little bit of help from our friends in South Asia, who might have earlier access to this film than those of us here in Europe or in the U.S. About a year ago, on one rainy Sunday morning, I went out to get some stuff at the local store here, and I noticed that on the street corner near our house, there was a film crew from Bollywood, and they were getting set to shoot a scene for a Bollywood movie, an important Bollywood movie involving one of the top stars, if not the top stars, in the Indian film industry. You guys will know who I'm talking about. The Big B was involved. Anyway, I was the star, of course, and I immediately got on the cell phone and called my wife and said, come on down, this will be fun to watch. Let's watch them shoot the movie and let the kids see how they make a movie. So she quickly got them dressed and a few minutes later joined me down there. We were standing there on the street corner watching all the preparations. They were setting up a big machine to make artificial rain because they needed a rainy scene, and miracle of miracles, it wasn't raining in London at that particular moment. All of a sudden, one of the people working on the movie came over and asked us if we would like to participate in the film as extras. We said, of course, yes, great. Our big break in Bollywood was right there before us. You know, the family still laughs about this every once in a while, but of the four of us, only one of us was rejected right off the bat by Bollywood, and that's yours truly. I was denied an opportunity to be a Bollywood star. I don't know. I guess good sense prevailed, and they realized that I might hurt film sales. So I was asked to step aside, but my wife and two kids were asked to participate, and they were all they needed to do was kind of walk down the street with an umbrella and walk past the star and the leading lady as they came out of a restaurant on a rainy day. Now, the trailer for the film is out, and I know that the scene in which the family was involved is in the movie, but the trailer bit was so short that I can't tell whether they're actually in there. So if anybody sees this movie, it's called, and my Hindi pronunciation will be awful, but it's called Chini Kum. With the Big B. It should be coming out in the next few weeks. If any of you guys see it, let me know if we're in it. Let me know if you see a woman with two small kids walking down the streets of London in the rain there as the Big B talks to the leading lady. Right. Forgive me there for the brief foray into Bollywood, but I couldn't resist, and we were talking about India, so there it came up. Hey, Bill, get the gong. Bring me up the gong here. And, wait a second. Okay. Stand by. Billy's holding the gong. Ooh. I think we might have overmodulated on that one. Sorry. Okay. Time for a Solder Smoke mailbag. I just wanted to read you a few lines from the email from Mike that had the audio clips. It says here he describes his rig and says that he's only for his satellite station, he's only running 5 watts into a 7 element Yagi 3 element Yagi on receive using a homebrew converter ahead of the Yellcraft K2. So there's another reason to be interested in these clips. The audio, the satellite pass that you were listening to was coming through to you through a K2. Excellent. It says here, Mike says he's been doing a little solder smoking, working on his trusty Yellcraft KX1, adding in an 80 meter module to the rig. What else do we have here? We got some nice email from Al, K4BVL. Al's age 76, and listens to Solder Smoke during his daily 3-mile walk. So we're glad to be keeping you company on the long walk there. Al, keep at it. Scott Haley in Tulsa sends us an email saying that he listens to Solder Smoke. He didn't give a call, so I'm not sure whether he's a radio amateur, but we're delighted to have you listening, Scott. And I mentioned that we have another listener in Tulsa, and maybe you guys should link up there and as Solder Smoke fans. And speaking of links, we got a nice email from Steve W2MY, and he gave us a nice message about a linked coupled tuner that he's building. Our friend Thomas up there in Oslo sent some nice email, and he's continuing to work on his spectrum analyzer. Good luck with that, Thomas. And Thomas has very kindly told me that he's going to send me in the mail the chips needed to build the W7ZOI power meter that I so desperately need here at the M0HBR workshop. So thanks very much to Thomas for making that very kind and very fraternal offer for the parts support. All right, guys, that brings us to the end of Solder Smoke 55. I hope you've enjoyed this one. It's kind of been kind of out there in terms of outer space, but anyway, it's been fun. Keep those emails coming in. We really like to get feedback. And again, if one way you could help with Solder Smoke is to create a link on your web page to the Solder Smoke page, that would be a big help and would help get out the word about the podcast to people who might enjoy listening to it. So, from Central London, 73s to the big group from M0HBR.